from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Monday, October 24th, near the site of the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline. Protesters, both Native American and their allies, occupied land that stands in the path of that pipeline. The protesters explained that the land's rightful owners are Native Americans under a treaty with the U.S. government that dates back about 150 years. But a Texas-based energy company disputes that, saying that they have the right to go forward with development. They claim that they bought the tracts of land and also relied on eminent domain to clear the route for the pipeline across four states, stretching from North Dakota to Illinois. The treaty in question is the Fort Laramie Treaty. I suspect you had never heard of it. Most of us aren't educated much, if at all, regarding Native American history. But that treaty is designed to protect and honor the land of the Great Sioux Nation. And the tribe contends that construction of this pipeline would damage their sacred and historical sites. They worry that spills could contaminate drinking water. And this is a reminder that these treaties are not supposed to be window dressing or historical artifacts with no modern significance. 1 week from today marks the 222nd anniversary of the Canandaigua Treaty, and Treaty Day celebrations are coming. But this hour we explore why it's not meant to only be a one-day celebration, although we will tell you everything that's coming up, and it's a full day of events next Friday. But the treaties are supposed to still have meaning, and that is at the core of what's happening in the Dakotas. It's at the core of what happens here as well. Let me welcome my guests for the hour, and they include Peter Jemison, the site manager of Ganondagan State Historic Site. Peter, welcome as always.
Thank you, Evan.
And Jamie Jacobs is here, Tonawanda Seneca language teacher and tradition bearer. And Jamie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
We got a big day coming up next Friday, and I promise we're going to get there. But I kind of want to start right where the news is hottest, Peter, which is the Dakota Access Pipeline. Is this to you an indication that these treaties are not, number one, supposed to have significance, but number two, sometimes broken or threatened?
It is to me, yes. You know, this treaty really promises to protect the lands of the Lakota people, of the Sioux people, of the Great Sioux Nation, as it said. And it promises that, you know, this land will be theirs for their use and in perpetuity. And, you know, almost immediately, I think it was as early as the treaty was signed in 1868, as early as 1869, gold was discovered in the Black Hills, and everything began to go kind of downhill from that point, Evan. And here, this is what the people who are opposing this Dakota Access Pipeline are saying is, you know, we're going back to our treaties. We have a right to occupy this area because this, according to our treaty with the United States government, is our land. It's our land that's protected. And really, what they're talking about is protecting the water, not just for themselves, but protecting the water for all of those people who basically live downstream on the Missouri River. So they're really coming at it from, I would say, two moral stands about this idea.
Okay. Jamie, what stands out to you? I mean, what do you want people who maybe grew up with very little education on Native American history, on treaties, what do you want them to understand about what you're seeing there?
Well, growing up in the culture, back in the Tonawanda territory there, a lot of what we're taught to believe is that we take care of our Mother Earth. Because the Mother Earth provides for us every day, every night. We grasp everything that we need. She provides it day and night. So I think one of the main issues here is water, healthy drinking water. We, you know, in our culture, the water is the life force of everything that grows here and for the people that live here. So to me, I think what the people need to understand is that it's not really just a land, it's not really just an issue about recognizing treaties, but it's a issue of humanity, protecting the land. Otherwise, what are we going to have in the future? So growing up in the culture, we're always taught to be thankful for every day that we're given, everything that we're the Creator and the Earth has provided us to live here. So I think what a lot of people need to understand is that it goes beyond just recognizing treaties. It goes to being thankful and most importantly for future generations.
Well, here's a comment already from a listener named Joel who just writes that, please remember many tribes did not sign treaties with the U.S. That did not sign treaties with the U.S. government were instead forced onto reservations, often on marginal lands. Colonialism and the assault on sacred lands is still getting played out here in the 21st century. You agree with that, Peter?
Yeah. I mean, there were, you know, people who chose, in the case of the Fort Laramie Treaty, to really go to Montana, you know, as a as an alternative to being, you know, saying being told, here, this is your land and this is where you're supposed to be staying. They preferred to not go on that land because, again, it was, you know, someone telling them what belonged to them. And, you know, it really, in our original teachings, our people felt we were like the birds. We were like the animals in the sense that there were no boundaries. Like, there was no reason that you couldn't go to a certain part of this country and enjoy that country or use the resources of that country in a manner that you didn't destroy it all. You left it there for those coming after you. As Jamie was talking about, this notion of being thankful, of really seeing the land as our source of life and the water as our source of life. And so, you know, when people tried to be directed by the federal government, which, you know, was really not after our best interests, the majority of the time, people resisted.
Well, I would defer to both of you if you wanted to give us just a brief rundown or a kind of a snapshot history lesson of the Fort Laramie Treaty, for example.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, perhaps later Orrin Lyons will join us, he brought something up the other night, which I thought was really interesting. We were in a conversation about this Dakota Access Pipeline at Rochester Institute of Technology. And he said, when this treaty was offered, Red Cloud said, if you're going to sign a treaty with us, first thing I want you to do is burn all of the forts that you have built within our traditional homelands. And the U.S. did. The U.S. went out and burned all the forts to the ground.
This is in the 1860s?
This is in the 1860s in order to get the Fort Laramie Treaty signed by the leaders, you know, at that time. And then the next thing we have is we have a statement that George Armstrong Custer is going out there to find a new location for a fort, all right? And we kind of know where that goes, right? We know where that goes downhill immediately. And, of course, he winds up paying with his life for the things that he did. But in other words, what they were attempting to do was, you know, this is the part that's kind of most people don't know. The intent of some of these treaties that were made was really to create an apartheid state. In other words, saying, okay, for example, Oklahoma, once you go there, that will be Indian land for now and forever, and we'll take all the people on the East Coast and we'll kind of ship them out there. We'll ask them to move themselves over there. We'll march them over there forcibly. We'll do whatever, you know, and create these type of really what were apartheid states at that time. Now, of course, we couldn't see all of that, you know. I mean, who knew how this country was going to develop? But the issue always became, who had the right to come and take our lands from us? That's really what these issues became. So the Fort Laramie Treaty was an attempt to define at least what land should belong to the Great Sioux Nation and how to achieve some type of a peace. Because the U.S. Army basically, at the close of the Revolutionary War, directed its attention to those people that they considered to be hostile to the United States. What they're talking about is people who are trying to protect their homelands. They're trying to protect their way of life. They're trying to protect the resource, which is the bison, which was their source of food and their water and et cetera, et cetera. They're trying to protect that.
And so forgive me on you know some of the historical background, but if you go back to the Fort Laramie Treaty, compared to what is recognized and respected today, how much of the territory today, more than 150 years or whatever, almost 150 years later, is still respected and honored as the way it was drawn up?
I would have to say a fraction. There are some very large, you know, what we now call reservations in South Dakota, North Dakota. But this is the other part that, and this is my personal view, okay? In my personal view, this country has never stopped punishing the Sioux for killing Custer. This sounds crazy, but I'm telling you, I've been to communities in South Dakota. They are the poorest communities I have ever been into any place in the United States. Me personally, I'm talking about now. I'm sure there are places of high poverty I have not visited, but some of the communities in South Dakota that I have visited, it's just really heartbreaking to see the level of poverty. And, you know, it's long been said that the Pine Ridge Reservation and the county there is the poorest county in the United States. Now, how do you account for that after all of this time has elapsed and the situation is not any better, and it probably is worse than it was at certain points in the past?
Well, I think the supporters of the Dakota Access Pipeline are going to make the claim that this is about economic development, maybe for everyone. Isn't there a possible benefit to everyone? And what's the rejoinder to that, Peter?
That is how it's sold. It's always sold that this is how you get cheaper heating oil. This is how you get cheaper gas at the pump. This is how, you know, we continue to not have to rely on overseas suppliers of oil to us. All right. And this is how it's always sold. Okay. There is never the discussion of maybe we should cut back the use of fossil fuels. Maybe we don't have to create the pollution that exists on the tar sands that is being created because of the method by which we are extracting that oil. Maybe we need to look at alternative sources of energy that are not controlled by the auto industry, that are not controlled by the petroleum industry or the rest of that. Those discussions just don't happen.
And so when it comes to what's going on with this treaty, the Fort Laramie Treaty, and the protests, the debate over the Dakota Access Pipeline, Peter mentioned before the hour began that the extraordinary step of an American president weighing in has happened. I wonder how you feel about what the president has said, and why don't you remind our listeners what you've heard from the president and what you think the significance is, Peter?
Well, what I've heard so far is that he has asked if the Army Corps of Engineers would look at alternatives. And how that started, did the Army Corps of Engineers initiate this? Did they receive a directive, those people who are right on the ground? Did the president suggest this and it made its way, there? I don't know, because I'm certainly not on the inside of that kind of discussion. But even the fact that the president of the United States should even weigh in on a question like this, where naturally the opponents, the people who are going to be lobbying for energy and lobbying for oil and all of the rest of it, these very powerful interests will come after you. I mean, come after you. So he's well aware of what happens when he says what he's chosen to say. I'm impressed that he has chosen this. I think it has also probably been a factor that he has had a number of listening sessions and exchanges with Native American leaders. Over the time that he's been in office, there have been some that have been conducted. Some were quite public, some were quite private. But he has been listening and he's been having conversations. What the substance of those are, what the results of those are, perhaps this is one of those.
Okay. So before we move to the Canandaigua Treaty, because Treaty Day is a week away here, I think this is a timely discussion, because Canandaigua Treaty Day comes when there are questions on whether treaties are really being honored. Is the Dakota Access Pipeline, is this debate about the Fort Laramie Treaty, is this a test of whether these treaties mean anything anymore? Is that too strong? Jamie, how do you feel about that?
Yes, I believe so. Like I said, these treaties were meant to protect what little we were given, what little that remained. Like, for example, the Senecas. I don't like to use the term reservation, because here where the Senecas are located today, we were living there already before colonialism, before the United States. So for those that were pushed out into the plains, they were given certain tracts of land. They were guaranteed by these treaties. And again, going back to the culture, we were always taught to look for the benefit of the future generations. It's up to our leaders to work hard to make sure that they ensure that the future generations have a healthy lifestyle. That's their responsibility in the culture. So it's also their job to make sure that the relationships with the federal government, that they're always recognizing that fact that, these are promises that our ancestors made, your forefathers made. So we have to work together. It's not just your Americans. It's not just, Native Americans. It takes both sides to do that. So when it boils down to this, a treaty is an agreement between two groups, two individuals, or in this case, the United States and then the tribes. So they both have to work together. They both have to look at both sides. They both have to come to some kind of consensus as to how they can both honor the treaties, not just the one side.
Okay. Peter, is this a test of whether modern treaties and modern-day treaties mean anything?
I think it is. I think it will become one. You know, it probably, as you said, most Americans never heard of the Fort Laramie Treaty. And so all of a sudden, people bring up the Fort Laramie Treaty. And then all of a sudden, a real conversation starts about, well, what does the Fort Laramie Treaty say? What does the Fort Laramie Treaty mean? And so for a lot of people, their eyes will be opened. And so I would say yes, because it's a test in the sense that now we actually look at what does it mean? You know, and as Jamie pointed it out, it is an agreement between two parties. And at the time that these agreements were made, the United States was acknowledging that these were sovereign nations with their own governments, with their own way of life. And here over here was the United States, you know, a sovereign. And they were acknowledging this. They were acknowledging the fact that they were equals. And now they're making an agreement. Okay. They didn't suddenly become less equal. They're still human beings. They're still living there where they were always living. And now we have to figure out how do we come to some type of a compromise that is for the benefit of those who are yet unborn. This is part of what Jamie's talking about, this looking forward, not to the immediate need or to some perceived immediate financial gain, but looking forward to what is the future for those young people that are coming.
I just want to offer an observation, as Peter says, exactly what Jamie's been saying, which is, you know, this is so often about future generations. I don't know anyone in this country who is more in tune with making sure we are thinking truly long-term than our Native brothers and sisters. It's really remarkable. Because when we talk about energy, for example, we talk about consumption. We talk about building and we talk about population. We talk about all these different things and we talk about long-term and we always say, well, in 10 years, in 20 years. Our Native American brothers and sisters are always thinking about future generations. It comes up in every conversation I have with Peter, Michael Galban, so many others. And I think there's remarkable wisdom there. We're talking about treaties today. We're talking about the Fort Laramie Treaty. We're talking about the Canandaigua Treaty. Canandaigua Treaty Day is a week away. If you haven't read the story of the Fort Laramie Treaty, which is at the heart of the Dakota Access Pipeline debate, if you haven't read the story of the Canandaigua Treaty, these are fascinating and vital American histories. And if you do Google searches, you often find stuff written by that man, Peter Jemison, who one of our listeners just referred to as one of the greatest living New Yorkers. He is one of our guests. He's the site manager of Ganondagan State Historic Site. Jamie Jacobs is here, Tonawanda Seneca language teacher and tradition bearer. But we'll link to them. If you want to jump on Twitter, jump on our Twitter account, Evan Dawson on Twitter, MMAC Media on Twitter, that's Megan Mack, the producer. We will link to some of the articles and the stories about these treaties, because if you didn't grow up with this history, it's a great chance to start playing a little catch-up and educating yourself. And I've had to do it too, and I think it's really, really important. If you want to call the program, any questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jamie mentioned you don't like the term reservation. Is that a hurtful term to Native Americans?
Well, to me personally, it is.
Okay.
Because like I said, my ancestors had these lands. They utilized them well before colonization for their natural resources, and they did everything they could to protect them. So to say a reservation, it was reserved for us, I don't think that's really historically true, because we were already living there.
So don't say reservation, say native land, say what?
One of the terms where people are using more commonly now is our territory. So we say the Seneca Nation territory, Cattaraugus territory, or the Allegheny territory. It's just that it kind of goes away from the idea that, you know, as he pointed out, someone reserved this for us. We held these lands as an allodium, meaning we were occupying the land before people came here, so you can't give us the land on which we're living.
Yes, I certainly take that point. And as we shift to look at Canandaigua and the Canandaigua Treaty, Here's an email from a listener named Jack who just says, Evan, can you tell us how many Native American people live in New York State and generally where their territories are? I'm embarrassed to say I have no idea. That's from a listener named Jack. You're kind of laughing, Peter, at that.
Well, it's a frequently asked question. I mean, it is. And you know, I'm sad to say that I probably don't have real accurate, you know, numbers to give him. I always try to, you know, give some sort of an answer, but it's very hard because there are a lot of Native Americans who live in the cities of this state who come from communities all over the United States. You know, they're not necessarily from our Six Nations. They come from other communities. And many of them settle in the largest cities because that's where they can make a livelihood. So, again, how do we ever get a handle on how many of them are living? And then, you know, if we're just talking about, let's just use the term, which, again, Jamie and I wouldn't use this one first, Indians. I mean, if you go to certain areas of Brooklyn, where I have been, you will be walking in the brownest city you've ever been in, right? Because all those people who come up from, and, you know, I'm not directing anyone there, but I'm just saying to you that, you know, who are working in all of these places that nobody else will take those jobs, they're living there. And are we going to count them? We're going to take into account that these people are indigenous people who live in this city. And then there's the population, which is the population that originally comes from this area of the world.
Okay. So Jack did our best to answer that for you, but we're going to continue now as we look at the Canandaigua Treaty. Beth on Twitter says, Evan, this is such an important conversation, and it shows me how ignorant I am of Native American history. Right there with you, Beth. We've mentioned on this program many times, we've got to do a lot better in terms of educational settings. Jane on Twitter says, Evan, thanks for today's topic. I'm a Native American, and there's not enough education regarding our life. Exactly right. That's what we're talking about. So next Friday, it's a big day. It's Canandaigua Treaty Day, 222nd anniversary. And I'll just start with some of the outlines. 10:30 to 7 p.m. at the Canandaigua Primary School and Courthouse. Events are free and open to the public. And what do you want the public to know about what's happening next week?
Okay. Well, we gather at the, we call it the West Gibson Street Elementary School, for the purpose of having, you know, a light lunch there. And those who are going to participate in the parade, which will take place in the later afternoon, we march from the West Gibson Street Elementary School to the lawn of the Ontario County Courthouse on Main Street with the goal of getting there at 2 o'clock. So those that are intending to walk with us will be gathering at the West Gibson Street Elementary School and we'll be, you know, greeting one another, sharing some good times and sharing a little bit of food. Then we go to the lawn of the Ontario County Courthouse. There's a rock there known as the Treaty Rock. We meet in that area and we commemorate this treaty. And very often Jamie offers our words of thanksgiving. We call them the words that come before all others. And I would really go back to Jamie to actually talk about that. So a program of speakers will take place, a relatively short program. We try to not make it too long because we never know what the weather's going to be like. It could be extremely cold. It could be raining out. It could be a beautiful day like today. We also acknowledge that we've planted there a tree we call the Tree of Peace. It's a white pine. It's a symbol of our Confederacy. And so we acknowledge that. Oftentimes, we urge people to stop at the Ontario County Historical Society because one of the two copies of the treaty that were made in 1794 is there at the Ontario County Courthouse for viewing, an original treaty. And then we go back to the West Gibson Street Elementary School where we will have a dinner, another short program of speakers, and social dancing in the evening finishes it off. But if Jamie is willing, I'd like to go back because he's been talking about this quite a bit, about these words that come before all others, if we can fit that.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Jamie.
Sure, I'll do my best. So as you stated in the beginning of our program, that I'm a ritual custodian, a Seneca language teacher. I grew up very traditional, and when I say traditional, I grew up immersed in the culture. I did not grow up speaking my own language. I attended public school, and then later on in life, I spent a lot of time with my older relatives, and they taught me a lot about the culture. And not knowing it, I did grow up immersed in the culture. But anyways, I grew up in ceremony, and today I'm a ritual keeper. And in these rituals, there's the one message that's always preached, and the one thing that's always mentioned over and over at every ceremony, every ritual, is the fact that as human beings, we take from the land. The earth is providing everything that we need to survive. Every little thing, right down to our Mother Earth, is where we begin. And we go all the way up to the sky, to where we believe is where our Maker lives. So everything in between, they all have this relationship to us. So when Europeans arrived here, they couldn't understand the fact that the sun had a life. They couldn't understand the fact that the moon had a force. So they considered us heathens, because we believed that all these things were alive and that they had life forces. So later on, when Europeans began to understand a little bit more through science, that there is a relationship between the sun, the moon, the stars, the thunder, everything that the earth is here, everything that's here on earth is here because all these things work in unison. And we're finding out that when one of these things are off balance, that something happens. It's like a domino effect. So even in our own culture, in the year 1800, an individual amongst our people stood up and he said, this is what our people are going to have to do to survive in the future. And he also told some prophetic messages. He said, this is what's going to happen later on in the future. And some of the things that he had told back then have come true, and some of them are coming true today, even with the pipeline. He did say, and again, this is 1800. This is a time when people could not even fathom the things that he was saying at that time. He said, you'll see a time when the earth will become very warm. You'll see a time when you'll see rivers of oil flowing over the land. And he also said that you're going to see a time that all these things, that people all over the earth will be in conflict. So this individual, we know him as in English as Handsome Lake. And I guess you could say that some of the things he was saying at the time could be self-fulfilling. But at that time, in 1800, the Seneca people were going through this transition time from living in longhouses, from going about wherever they please, to being told that they had to stay on these small tracts of land. I guess what we call now reservations. So it was a very important time for pretty much mainly the Seneca people. The other nations of the Five Nations went through their own history, but for the Seneca people, these were the things that they had to be prepared for, that they were preparing for at the time. And this is kind of a result as to where the Treaty of Canandaigua comes in, because it happens around the same time. So it's only 6 years later is when, you know, or 5 years later is when this prophet, I guess we call as Handsome Lake, he comes out and he says these things to the people. So these issues that we're talking about now, they were talking about them then, in 1800, 1799, and then even later on, you know, in the Industrial Age happens here in North America, and all these things that, you know, that he told about, you know, they started to come true. And again, his message there, he had kind of prophesied this even back then, that this is what's going to happen. And we look at these and we use these as to how we can address these issues. What did he say that we can use so that we can be prepared from, you know, for what's coming?
Well, let's get our only break of the hour. I've got a couple of people who want to weigh in on the phone, and we're going to come back to Don and Sean on the phone. And then we're going to kind of stay with this history that so many of us don't know much about. 222 years ago, the 1794, the Treaty of Canandaigua. What sort of brought it about to begin with? And Peter Jemison's going to help us with that. And we'll remind you before the hour's out, all of the events that are happening 1 week from today, that's the Treaty Day celebrations. It's all day in Canandaigua, and you don't have to be there all day. I'll probably pop down after the show next Friday, so maybe I'll see you in the afternoon. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and continue the discussion on Treaty Day next. Coming up in our second hour, a chance for all of us not only to vent together, but to discuss the stress we've been feeling about election season. Election stress disorder, according to the LA Times, is a real thing. And the stress that you may have been feeling is not just abnormal. In fact, there's a lot of people feeling this way. Relationships have frayed over this election, and we'll try to cope with that and deal next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me get to your phone calls. Don in East Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, good afternoon to your guests, too. I know more about the treaty of the Fort Laramie Treaty than I do about the Canandaigua Treaty. If anyone wants some information on the Fort Laramie Treaty, I recommend the book In the Spirit of Crazy Horse by Peter Mathiasen. I believe it was printed in the 1980s. It's now it may be out of print now, but I'm sure any library could have it. And it lays down exactly what happened in the 1850s and 60s when the Fort Laramie Treaty was signed and negotiated, and it was immediately abrogated by the United States government. It also talks about the war that has been waged against Native Americans since that time and before, and it continues to this day. And the book mainly talks a lot about Leonard Peltier and the American Indian Movement. Also, I would like to say one of your gentlemen guests there speaks in terms of colonization. That is exactly what it is. It is no different. The European colonization of North America was no different than the European colonization of Africa, Asia. It was to extract resources from the native people. So it was colonization in every sense of the word. No different than what happened in Africa, in Nigeria, in India, in Vietnam. In Vietnam, we had a good example of how the Viet Cong were resisting the colonization, much the same way that Native Americans today resist the colonization that exists here. And I'd like to hear, I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, Don, thanks very much here. Gentlemen, you want to take that?
I have one experience that I always refer to. I have a number of Maori friends, and I was first invited to New Zealand in 1986. And I went down and, you know, began to talk with the Maori people there. It was really the first time I visited their homeland. I had met them before, but I really got to their homelands. And when I listened to their history and I listened to their story, it was the same as ours. It was the exact same thing, colonization, taking their land away from them, you know, basically having to fight against, you know, someone who wants to extract the resources from your land, and being treated as though, you know, you don't have rights, you're ignorant, you're not a Christian, therefore you're a heathen, therefore we can do whatever we wish. You know, it was just so remarkable to me that, as the caller said, these things have been replicated time and again. You know, you can go from country to country, and it will be the indigenous people who will bear the worst of that. The worst, you know, it'll be worse on them.
Peter, how do you feel about the recommendation on the book that that Don made there?
Yeah, I think it's a good book. I think it's a good recommendation, and he's right. You know, there's a lot of it that's devoted to the American Indian Movement and to Leonard Peltier. But it also, as he says, you know, it's a good discussion of the Fort Laramie Treaty and the events that led to it.
Okay. Next up, Sean in Rochester. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, how's it going? I'm one of the organizers that organized the meeting for the International Socialist Organization out at RIT last week that Peter and Oren Lyons spoke at. I'd just like to relay a little of the information that Oren and Peter shared with us. It's really important about understanding our history and how most of us really don't understand the real history of America. A really striking point that Oren said was in 1492, when Columbus got to this land, there was 16 million Native people here. In 1900, there was 250,000. So that's a systematic genocide that happened, and something that's really glossed over in our history books. I'm actually a teacher, and I try to teach a full history, but it's very difficult to do so with the textbooks we're given. The other thing I'd like to say is what Oren really tried to tell us was about the history of Native culture. Their history was based on community, and it was based on the first principle of sharing. And he said that that way of life is contradictory to the way that this country was created and the form of capitalist economy that puts the profit of rich people and the ruling class over the people and the land. And then finally, that he mentioned that Native Americans have been the leaders of resistance against attacks on our environment throughout this whole history, and attacks on their sovereignty. This is very evident with what's going on in Standing Rock right now. And as they are showing the rest of us the way to fight back against the attacks on our environment that affect us all, they're showing us that we are all share the same interest in preserving this land and fighting back against any attempts to pollute this land and use it for the resources for the profit of a few at the expense of us all. And then finally, just anybody who is interested in this, there is a big rally and protest tomorrow at Liberty Pole at 3:00. Come out, find out more, start to educate yourself, and start to stand up and support those people who are on the front lines in Standing Rock. And thank you, Peter, for coming the other night. Thank you to the program for having this topic, and we really appreciate it. We need to educate, organize, and agitate. Thank you very much.
All right, Sean, thanks for the phone call. Gentlemen, I saw a lot of nods there. Anything you want to add to what he had to say?
I don't have anything to add. I think people should inform themselves. The more that they learn about this, the better they will be, because I know that things like this, once they get in the media, there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of misinformation out there. It would be best to try to find a reliable source of information. I happened to be coming home last night in my car, and the Susan Arbetter program was on last night, and she had on Joe Heath. Joe Heath is the attorney for the Onondaga Nation. Joe had just returned from Standing Rock. He had been out there for a week. He had been there during the time when people were being maced, when people were being having a number written on their arm, and they were being taken off to jails all over North Dakota. And, you know, people didn't know where they were. People didn't know how to find them. They didn't, you know, take their cell phone away from them and everything else. And Joe, you know, gave a firsthand account of what was going on there at a time when, you know, there were elders assembled and peaceably praying, and, you know, these forces that were, I mean, in armored personnel carriers, in, you know, with cannons that fire off these very large, loud sounds, with rubber bullets, with all the rest of it, you know, attacking people who are essentially peacefully protesting. And what he was bringing up again was contrasting that with the Bundy occupation of that federal park where they were armed.
Clavin Bundy, yeah.
And all of them have been exonerated in that case, as far as I understand it.
Well, let me just ask you before I go to our next phone call. Jamie and Peter, do you feel that the more the public does become educated on Native history, that you're feeling more allies from non-Native people? Are you feeling more allyship with... in other words, these protests are not just the Great Sioux Nation, just not just right. Native people. And is that true? Are you seeing that? Are you feeling that?
Yes, I do see that there are non-Native protesters. I do see that there are non-Native landowners who are being affected also by the pipeline. And I think that because that their way of life, their connection to the land, especially farmers who make their living off the land, they're starting to see now exactly the mind of how a Native American would think, that this is the land that's provided me a living, it's put food on the table for my family, and now it's being threatened. So I think that, you know, that people should educate themselves. Maybe they don't live off the land. Maybe they're not being threatened directly, such as myself. Even myself, I should probably be more educated on, you know, the pipeline, but I'm not. so, but I do feel that I think if people educate themselves a little bit more, I do feel more and more allies coming forward to help the cause. Because like I said at the beginning of the program, this is not just a Native American issue. It's a humanity issue, and it's going to affect us all. And it's, you know, the Native Americans who have decided to take the lead on this fight against, you know, big oil companies. Whereas up till, you know, a few years ago, there was always a fear to stand up, you know, to these oil companies because they do have unlimited resources. We know that. It's not nothing that, you know, we're not known to. So please get out there, educate yourself, you know, do what you can.
You know, I would echo what Jamie is saying and just say that obviously there are many friends of Ganondagan, you know, that people who come to our events and because they want to learn more, they want to enjoy the events that we're putting on. They become active supporters, you know, in whatever communities they may come from, because they learn a little bit more. Their eyes are opened by the people we bring to have conversations there, and that, you know, Ganondagan is open to the entire public. It's open to everyone. It's not limited to school groups. It's not limited to people who have to come as an organized group. Individuals can come any day. We're open Tuesday through Sunday. And it's there for us to be able to share our story, the story of the original people of this particular territory where we are, Evan, this, you know, what we now call the Western Finger Lakes, or we call the Rochester area, or we call it Victor. But those were original homelands to our people, and we call ourselves Onondaga, people of the Great Hill. We use the term Seneca, that's an English name that has been given to us, but actually that word has no meaning in our language. But yes, we have many allies, and I appreciate them all. I hope you hear my voice saying to you how much I do appreciate your support and your interest.
Let me get John in Henrietta next up. Go ahead, John.
Hi, I'm a transplant in upstate New York from California, where I'm a third-generation native. I grew up in the San Jose area, so-called Silicon Valley. And in growing up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, I had classmates who were of various ethnic backgrounds because California is, an immigration state, if you will. But I did learn in undergraduate anthropology that the native people that preceded the Europeans and even the Spanish, you know, moved all over that huge area, and there was archaeological, you know, findings in the San Francisco Bay tidal lands of things that came from what I'll loosely call tribes, and I apologize if that's an offensive term, from other parts of California. These people traded back and forth, moved all around. They had routes and regions. Then the Spanish came, and then, of course, the Europeans came after that. But the natives people there, you know, were basically it was not illegal to kill them, as it was not illegal to kill the Chinese that were brought in to help build the railroads later. So it was a real genocide that went on in California to clear the lands for the rest of the world to come to. That's my comment.
Thanks for the phone call. And anything to add?
No, it's tragic. I mean, the people, you have that story of Ishii. Ishii became the last living person of his nation, you know. The rest of the members of his nation suffered at the hands of genocide being deprived of the resources that were limited in the area where they lived, but they had found a way to live there. That was their home, and they knew how to live there.
Well, before we lose the hour here, I know we've been talking about the events of next Friday on Treaty Day in Canandaigua, marking 222 years since the signing of the Treaty of Canandaigua. But if you are like so many of us, and you don't really know the background and the basics, Peter Jemison, can you give us some of the historical context of what was going on in 1794 that led to that treaty?
Yeah, you know, I guess some of my teachers that I've had in the past, they always told me, you know, you kind of have to start at the beginning. You can't kind of just jump into the middle and make it understandable. You have to kind of give a what happened first and how did we get to there. So let's just start with the idea that occupying this land, you know, that we now call New York State, there were many, many nations. Among them were a group of people that we call Haudenosaunee people. and we had been united by a message of peace, power, and righteousness. I'm going to say a little over 1,000 years ago. Some might argue it was 2,000 years ago. So we're living on this land, right? And now Europeans are coming into our midst, and many of them are seeking things like fur. You know, they're looking for opportunities to find various resources that they can sell someplace in the world. Okay, and among those were the French, the Dutch, and the English. We made allies of the English because the English sent over here a man known as Sir William Johnson. And his job was to make friends with native people, right? His job was to be a liaison from the English to the native people. He educated a man by the name of Joseph Brant. He was raised in his home. He married Joseph Brant's sister, Molly. So we have, you know, here a person who was basically native, who was Mohawk, but he was very much under the influence of the Anglican education and under the influence of Sir William Johnson. Eventually, war breaks out. You know, we have the French and Indian War of the 1750s, and then we get into the Revolutionary War, and, you know, we have a quote, Americans seeking independence, all right? Now, I always say that's a nice sounding story, but the real story is the question of who has the right to take the lands of the people who live west of the East Coast? Who has the right to take these lands that are far beyond, you know, the limitations of the of New England and beyond the limitations of the East Coast? And this is really, this becomes the issue. So now there's this war. We call it the Revolutionary War. The revolutionaries breaking away from the rule of England. People came to us and came to among our people, and they asked us to join up with them. Some of our warriors, they sided with the English. Some of our warriors, they sided with the American cause. So war breaks out. We get involved in this conflict. It's hard to avoid it. It's fought in our lands. It's fought on our lands. They sent an army through here to try to wipe us out. The Sullivan-Clinton campaign rolls through here and burns out 40 towns, Cayuga and Seneca towns, destroys our food, everything we can eat. So then the war ends. A treaty is signed. It's called the Treaty of Paris of 1783. That treaty does not even mention us, does not mention Native people at all, doesn't mention the Six Nations warriors that were involved, doesn't mention our nations, nothing about us. So the assumption is that the spoils of war are there available to the Americans because they defeat the British. Therefore, they can come and take the lands, which we are occupying, by the way, which we are living on still. But we have been made refugees because of the Sullivan-Clinton campaign. We're living in now Western New York, living on what is now called Buffalo. This is the Buffalo Creek where we're living. We call it Doshowe.
2-minute warning. Keep going.
So we're living there. Now, what we find out is that people are coming onto our land, as this gentleman was talking about, and shooting us wantonly. And there are no repercussions. George Washington has disassembled his army, and we have no protection from these people coming and killing us. So we have to begin making journeys to Philadelphia to try to bring our case before George Washington and others there and say, listen, we need a treaty that clearly identifies what lands belong to us so we can stop these incursions of people coming to take our lives. It takes a long time. It basically takes from then until 1794. It takes 4 years at least. 1794, finally, he sends Timothy Pickering out here to the city of Canandaigua, very, very small town at the time, in the company of William Savory, a Quaker. And our people go there. Red Jacket, Corn Planter, the man he mentioned, Handsome Lake, Clear Sky, many others go there. And we go to negotiate to try to reach a peaceful agreement as two sovereigns. How are we going to go forward in life here? How are we going to live together peaceably so that we can enjoy our lives, you will enjoy your lives, and we will treat each other with respect? And a treaty is laid out which prescribes the way in which we deal with conflicts. It prescribes the way in which we should treat one another with peace and friendship. It describes that this is not, as Jamie was saying before, this isn't just about the Six Nations. This is the United States and the Six Nations joined together. They shake hands and they come up with a treaty. Signed November the 11th, 1794, ratified by the Congress January of 1795. And for us, that treaty is still in place today. It never got, it never disappeared. It has been violated endlessly, but for us, we have to maintain that that treaty is the way in which we should be living together in peace and friendship.
222 years, and if that was a history lesson that you just heard from Peter Jemison that you never got growing up, I never did, If what you heard from Jamie and Peter are new, then I think you're a perfect candidate to be out there a week from today. Starts at 10:30, goes to 7 p.m., the Canandaigua Primary School and Courthouse. There's food. There will be, as Peter said, a parade, all kinds of things. I think the Ganondagan State Historic Site website's got a little bit more information. Mm-hmm. So just Google Ganondagan State Historic Site. You can check out Treaty Day information. It's a 1 week from today and, of course, free and open to the public. Peter, as always, thank you for being here. It's great to see you. Jamie, great to see both of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for this opportunity.
You got it. And we'll continue to have these kind of conversations. Let's have this short break and more connections. Thanks.